Thanks so much, Brooke.
Brooke.
Yes, so we are on two employers. Not vision for you. So I will go ahead and pretend that I just read a little bit of two of the employers to prepare, because instead of, I'm well prepared for next week. I'll just leave it there. So my name is Carrie. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My home group is the New Horizons Group in beautiful Bend, Oregon, and I'm currently living in the disciplines of steps 10, 11, and 12. And my sponsor is Beth M. out of my home group. And I love having a sponsor that's part of my group, and being able to attend meetings with her. So this chapter 10, two employers is again, right? It's another chapter to help me to practice these principles in all of my affairs. It's another chapter to help me work with others. It is from the non-alcoholic's perspective, the way it's written, even though it is written by an alcoholic. This is the only chapter that was not written by Bill W., the author of the big book. This was the only chapter that was written mainly by Hank P., one of the early founders. And so the language is very consistent, but it's a different style. And you guys will notice that, I hope. We'll see. Than what we've heard before. So I'm going to go ahead and start reading the first paragraph on page 136, which starts out, "Among many employers nowadays, we think of one member who has spent much of his time in the world of big business. He's hired and fired hundreds of men. He knows the alcoholic as the employer sees him. His present views ought to prove exceptionally useful to businessmen everywhere, but let him tell you." So that was an introduction saying why they think it would be beneficial to have Mr. Hank P. Take on most of this, right? And I'm assuming it's because Bill W. never really owned a business. He never really had employees. And so it was better suited to have somebody who has that kind of experience to write this. So I'm going to skip down to the bottom of page 136, where it says, "Another time as I opened a letter which lay on my desk, a newspaper clipping fell out. It was the obituary of a man, of one of our best salesmen I ever had. After 2 weeks of drinking, he had placed his toe on the trigger of a loaded shotgun." I don't mean to laugh at that. "The barrel was in his mouth. I had discharged him for drinking 6 weeks before." Not something to laugh about. And I apologize. The reason I laughed is because back in the day when I was growing up in AA, and I hung out with a lot of old timers. Like all the other girls my age, they, found girls their age, and I liked the crusty old guys that would tell me how it is. And I listened to a lot of debates, about, "Wait, show me trigger in the book. Where's the word trigger in the book?" And I saw a lot of people want win money on saying page 137, right? You can find the word trigger. But he had placed his toe on the trigger of a loaded shotgun. It's not saying that we need to find our triggers, as an example of a as drinking triggers, because we all know, right, Tuesday was a trigger. So still another experience. "A woman's voice came faintly over long distance from Virginia. She wanted to know if her husband's company insurance was still in force. 4 days before, he had hung himself," or I guess it says hanged himself, "in his woodshed. I had been obliged to discharge him for drinking, though he was brilliant, alert, and one of the best organizers I've ever known." So far, we're kind of hearing not a lot of hope. Like, we have to let these alcoholics go, and sometimes that means they die, which is not a lot of hope, but the chapter picks up. So it's t now it says, "Here were three exceptional men who lost to this world because I didn't understand alcoholism as I do now. What irony. I became an alcoholic myself." And for the intervention of an understanding person, I might have followed in their footsteps. One of the things you'll notice is the rest of this book doesn't use the word intervention, right? Bill kind of insinuated things like intervention was what he called frothy emotional appeal. My downfall cost the business community unknown thousands of dollars, for it takes real money to train a man for an exceptional position or an executive position. This kind of waste goes on unabated. We think the business fabric is shot through with a situation which might be helped by better understanding all around. Nearly every modern employee feels a moral responsibility for the well-being of his health, and he tries to meet these responsibilities. My next highlight, I'm going to just skip down a little bit. The employer has sometimes kept such a man at work long before a reasonable period. Some employers, have tried every known remedy. In only a few instances, there's been a lack of patience and tolerance. So now it's kind of starting to describe, even when we do have patience and tolerance, even when we do give them opportunity after opportunity, and we who have imposed on the best employers can scarcely blame them if they've been short with us. Here, for instance, is a typical example. An officer of one of the largest banking institutions in America knows I no longer drink. One day, he told me about an executive of his, an executive of the same bank, who, from his description, was undoubtedly alcoholic. This seemed to me like an opportunity to be helpful. So I went and I spent 2 hours talking about alcoholism, the malady, and described the symptoms and results as well as I could. There's my highlight. His comment was very interesting, but I'm sure this man is done drinking. He has just returned from a 3-month leave of absence, had taken a cure, looks fine, and to clinch the matter, the board of directors told him that this was his last chance, right? And as we know, because of earlier in the book, especially on page 20 into 21, if he were just a heavy drinker, or if he were just physically addicted to alcohol, the employer probably would be right. He's got all the reasons in the world not to drink. He's going to lose his job if he drinks again. But we know that the real alcoholic, no amount of, well, frothy emotional appeal, but no also amount of wanting to, is going to keep anybody sober if they're a real alcoholic. So the only answer I could make was that if this man followed the usual pattern, he would go on a bigger bust than ever. I felt it was inevitable and wondered if the bank was doing the man an injustice. Why not bring him into contact with some of our alcoholic crowd? He might have a chance. I pointed out that I had nothing to drink whatsoever for 3 years, and this in the face of difficulties that would have made 9 out of 10 men drink their heads off. Why not at least afford him an opportunity to hear my story? Oh no, said my friend, this chap is either through with liquor or he's minus a job. If he has your willpower and guts, he will make the grade. Right? So this is just another example of non-alcoholics not understanding that it's not willpower and guts, that it's absolutely the opposite of willpower and guts, that it's actually the exact opposite of willpower, which is giving your will up, right? And nobody's going to understand that, and you can't expect them to. Presently, the man did slip and was fired. following his discharge, we contacted him. Without much ado, he accepted the principles and procedure that has helped us. So he's actually, like, they 12-stepped him, and he's showing some willingness, and he's taking what they're calling the procedure, so the principles. He is undoubtedly on the road to recovery. To me, this incident illustrates lack of understanding as to what really ails the alcoholic, and lack of knowledge as to what part employers might profitably take in salvaging their sick employees. So my notes that I made on a different night, because I didn't really prep tonight, are pages 18 and 19. So let's see why I have that written in my book. Because highly competent psychiatrists who have dealt with us find it. So it's just showing that there's no amount of people who understand. People don't understand that the alcoholic is a very sick person, right? And the employers are obviously going to think, well, if it means losing their job, then they won't drink again. So that's probably why my notes on that. And then going down to the bottom of that page on 139, it says, when dealing with an alcoholic, there may be natural annoyance. Now, I have this highlighted, and I'll read the rest of this. I have this highlighted again, and I haven't said it this week, but I have said it in the past couple of weeks, that these forgotten four, if you will, these chapters after working with others, they are a continuation of working with others. And for me, because of that, I can pull the principles out of where it applies to sponsees, of where it applies to the new people that I work with today. And this is a really good one for me to remember when dealing with an alcoholic, like a newcomer that I'm trying to sponsor, right? There may be a natural annoyance that a man could be so weak, stupid, and irresponsible. Who am I? Like, that's scary. When I catch myself having those thoughts about a newcomer that I'm working with, like, how can they be so stupid? It's like, oh no, I was that newcomer. I couldn't get 3 to 5 days put together. That's scary that I've gotten so far. When I get so far away from my last drink that I start to forget that, that's a sign to me that maybe I'm not working with enough newcomers, that maybe I'm not staying in that early recovery work, that maybe, you know, because women that I'm working with now are asking me to sponsor them that have sometimes more sobriety time than me, I need to always stay working with a newcomer. In addition to whatever, you know, in addition to the other women that I work with, I need to work with new people too, no matter what. I can't get that far away from this stuff. Even when you understand the malady better, you may feel this feeling arising. So this is saying it's normal, you know, even though I am an alcoholic, even though I do understand this malady, I still can get a little bit frustrated, right? I still can get a little bit of a, oh, why would you drink again? I thought we were on the right track, right? And who am I? Who am I? So page 140, here's a highlight. Can you discard the feeling that you're dealing only with habit, with stubbornness, or with weak will? Again, this isn't the first time this chapter has said, you know, has compared alcoholism to weak will, but this is the first time that it's comparing it to a habit. And I know that on page 20, let's reconcile that with page 20, on the bottom of page 20, because alcoholism isn't a habit, right? That's addiction. You can use your way into any addiction. You can use your way into any habit. But I know that for myself, I experienced an abnormal reaction to alcohol the first time I ever drank. And I was not addicted to alcohol the first time I ever drank. But I got more thirsty instead of quenched. It's an abnormal reaction to alcohol. That's what alcoholism is. And there are 100 different 12-step fellowships out there for addiction. AA is the only one that the alcoholic can come to learn about alcoholism, which has nothing to do with habits. And so on the bottom of page 20, it says, then we have a certain type of hard drinker, which we know today, they're referring to the non-alcoholic, right? The hard drinker is a non-alcoholic. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time, as if it's sufficient, so strong enough reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative. This man can stop or moderate. He has enough willpower to do that. All the hard drinker needs is willpower. Although he may find it difficult and troublesome, he may even need medical attention. So it's saying, you know, some people get so physically addicted to alcohol, they might even need to go to detox. That doesn't make them alcoholic. So yes, I have to remember on page 140, I need to discard the feeling that I'm dealing with only habit, with stubbornness, or with weak will. That's not what this monster of alcoholism is. Those things have nothing to do with alcoholism. If this presents difficulty, and I do forget, and I start to think that this person I'm trying to work with is just stubborn or weak-willed or has a habit, well, maybe rereading chapters 2 and 3, where the alcoholic sickness is discussed at length, might be worthwhile, which is why I turned back to chapters 2 in page 20, and I reread that a little bit, is because it cross-references there. You as a businessman want to know the necessities before considering the result. If you can see that your employee is ill, can he be forgiven for what he's done in the past? Can his past absurdities be forgotten? Can he be appreciated? Can it be appreciated that he has been a victim of crooked thinking directly caused by the action of alcohol on his brain? I well remember the shock I received when a prominent doctor in Chicago told me of cases where pressure of the spinal fluid actually ruptured the brain. No wonder an alcoholic is strangely irrational. Who wouldn't be with such a fevered brain? Normal drinkers, and here's my highlight, normal drinkers, right? And what is an alcoholic? An abnormal drinker. An alcoholic is someone with an abnormal reaction to alcohol. So normal drinkers who have normal reactions are not so affected, nor can they understand the aberrations of the alcoholic. I looked up the word aberrations, and it's a departure from what is normal. So again, the description of an allergy is an abnormal reaction, right? So the departure from what is normal, instead of getting quenched, I get more thirsty. And that's apparently abnormal. Apparently, only 10% of our society has that abnormal reaction like I have. I didn't know I was only part of such a minority when it comes to that abnormal reaction, but that's what aberrations means in the dictionary. Your man has probably been trying to conceal a number of scrapes, perhaps messy ones, perhaps pretty messy ones. They may be disgusting. You may be at a loss to understand how much a seemingly above board chap could be so involved, but these scrapes can generally be charged, no matter how bad, to the abnormal, there's another highlight, action of alcohol on his mind. So again, I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. I am bodily and mentally different from my fellows, from 90% of the rest of the world. When drinking or getting over a bout, an alcoholic, sometimes the model of honesty, when normal, will do incredible things after his, where am I? Afterward, his revolution, I'm probably not saying that word right, will be terrible. Nearly always these antics indicate nothing more than temporary conditions. This is not to say that all alcoholics are honest and upright when not drinking. Of course, this isn't so. And such people often may impose on you. Here we go. Here's a good highlight. This paragraph. Seeing your attempt to understand and help, some men will try to take advantage of your kindness. This is a warning to the employers, right? This is a warning to non-alcoholics that try to deal with us. If you're sure your man does not want to stop, he may as well be discharged. The sooner, the better. Don't be codependent here. You are not doing him a favor by keeping him on. Firing such an individual may prove a blessing to him. It may be just the jolt he needs. So I appreciate the neutrality in this chapter. I appreciate where it says, hey, you got to understand the alcoholic and you got to give him a chance. And you got to understand that he's a sick person, not a bad person. You got to understand he's not, you're not dealing with just a habit or weak will. You got to give him a chance, send him to treatment, send him to, you know, make sure that you have AA phone numbers for him, whatever. But if he doesn't want to stop, let him go because he's not gonna. Page 142. I'm going to skip down a little bit to the last line of that first big paragraph. Will he take every necessary step, submit to anything to get well, to stop drinking forever? Now, those are some good questions that an employer, it's suggesting that an employer can ask us drunks. And I think that those are some pretty clear cut instructions. Are you going to take those steps? Are you going to submit to anything to get well? That's just like in the previous chapters where it says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get better, well, then you're ready to take these certain steps, right? So the desire has to be there. The willingness has to be there or all else fails. If he says yes, so I love the fact that it goes through if he says yes, and then if he says no, so we'll get through those. So if he says yes, yes, I do want to stop. Yes, I'm willing to go to any lengths. Yes, I want to keep my job. Yes, give me a chance. Does he really mean it? Or down inside, does he think he's fooling you and that after rest and treatment, he will be able to get away with a few drinks now and then? We believe a man should be thoroughly probed on these points. Be satisfied that he is not deceiving himself or you. So that doesn't sound like you're going to be asking him or like I'm going to be asking my prospect, do you want to quit drinking just for today, just one day at a time? No, it sounds like I'm asking him, do you really want to stop drinking for good? Do you want to stop drinking because you have to have no reservations? If you want to stop drinking for good and for all, like what Bill says, let's do this. If not, you know, you got more research to do, my friend. Whether you mentioned this book is a matter for you, your discretion. If he temporizes and still thinks he can ever drink again, even beer, he might as well be discharged after the next bender, which if an alcoholic, he's almost certain to have. That's a warning for the employer right there. He should understand that empathetically. Either you're dealing with a man who can and will get well, or you're not. If not, why waste your time with him? This may seem severe, but it's usually the best course to take. After satisfying yourself that your man wants to recover and that he will go to any extreme to do so, now again, right, page 58, most meetings read it almost every single day when they read how it works. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it. And then again on page 90, it can be reconciled again where it says about a little after halfway down the page on page 90, it says, ask him if he wants to quit for good. And not or, if he would go to any extreme to do so. If he says yes, then his attention should be drawn to you as a person who has recovered. Now, this is just reiterating over and over again, very consistent with the message of every chapter up until now, that it's a twofold sickness, right? Body and mind, mind and body, but it's also a twofold question. Do you want to get better? Or do you want what we have? And if yes, are you willing to go to any lengths to get it? Because if no on either of those questions, hands off. Go get some more research. Page 143. Oh my goodness. My highlights are starting to fade. I need to get a new big book. Okay, so I like this highlight, Craves Liquor, and I don't know what context it is in, so I'm going to read it. Whatever the method, its object is to thoroughly clear mind and body. There's those two full, right? Mind and body, body and mind, mind and body, physically and mentally, of the effects of alcohol. Incompetent hands, this seldom takes long, nor is it very expensive. Your man will fare better if placed in a physical condition that he can think straight and no longer craves liquor. Okay, so again, just like in the doctor's opinion, it says that before he can actually start on the program of action, he needs to be physically free of his craving for liquor, and that's what a detox is for, right? Because as we know, the craving happens after the first drink goes down. The mental obsession is what happens preceding the first drink. That insanity, that subtle insanity that precedes the first drink is neck up. And then once it gets you, after you take the first drink, that's when the physical factor, the physical craving, you know, the fuse is lit, right? And although I have a very easy on switch, one drink, one sip, I don't have an off switch. Once that fuse is lit, I'm going to go off. So I have to get free from that physical craving before recovery can happen. So if your man accepts your offer, well, I'm going to skip down a little bit. Here's my next highlight. In the middle of page 143, we all had to place recovery above everything, for without recovery, we would have lost both home and business. I have heard a lot of people who have difference of not just opinion, but different experiences around that. And I respect them all. And there's some people who have, who I've heard has a very different experience than mine, and I can respect that. And it's true for them just the same as my experience is true for me. So with that said, my experience is I was told early on that I needed to plant my feet firmly in AA and then build my life up around that foundation. And that's just my experience. And that's reconciled with what this says here. You know, we had to place recovery above everything else. So for me, people look at me, and especially I feel like, and I don't know, a lot of it's in my head, you know, and I've talked to my sponsor about this and I've done inventory on it, but I feel like a lot of people that ask me to sponsor them or that I try to work with maybe are intimidated because of how much of my life I devote to AA. And it's like, I hope she doesn't expect me to do that, right? And that's a really, that's a legit concern. That's a legit question. There's no way in hell I would have asked somebody like me to sponsor them, because I wouldn't want them to expect me to do even half of what, you know, I do. And what I say to those people, because I don't expect that, you know, I don't have what people I sponsor, their programs look like and what they do is a minimal And then they can take it from there. You know, they can, they, whatever they need to do after that is up to them. So for me, my scenario is you got to put AA above everything else for sure, which means 70% of my life, and maybe that's embarrassing, I don't know, 65 to 70% of my life today is Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't expect that. Let's say 10% of alcohol, if your life is Alcoholics Anonymous. If somebody has a full life and only 10% of it is devoted to AA, what I expect is that 10% to come first and then the 90% come after. I don't expect you to make 50%, 60%, 65% like me your life. I expect you to take those three minimal requirements that I have, which for me is I'm a three legacy sponsor. So I have three requirements, base requirements, right? Number one, we work out of this big book. I'm going to take you through the 12 steps. I'm not a sponsor in name only. That's legacy one. That's requirement number one, the big book. Number two, after we go through the book, you're going to learn how to respect Alcoholics Anonymous. So we're going to go through the traditions. That's requirement two. And requirement three, you don't have to know the concepts. You don't have to go through the concepts. Concepts aren't going to save your life, but you're damn well going to respect the concepts. Like, you're going to have one home group. You're not going to do service in other people's home group. And so even if you don't understand the concepts, you're going to respect the third legacy of how our service structure is set up. So those are the only three requirements I have. And those don't take time. I mean, they take hardly any time. But I want those three things. I want your devotion and your loyalty to Alcoholics Anonymous and to your sobriety to come before everything else. Even if the rest of it is 90% and AA is only 10% of your life, needs to come first. It needs to be the first 10%. So page 145. Good. I'm doing good on time. Page 145, right in the middle of the page, the greatest enemy of us alcoholics, the greatest enemies of us alcoholics are resentment, jealousy, envy, frustration, and fear. That is a pretty powerful sentence. The greatest enemies of us alcoholics is not alcohol. It's resentment, jealousy, envy, frustration, and fear. It's my character defects. Now, do I have resentment, jealousy, envy, frustration, and fear because I'm an alcoholic? No. I have those things because I'm a human being. But these are the dubious luxuries of normal men. These are the dubious luxuries of non-alcoholics. But for me to engage in them, for me to sit in them, for me to sit in them for too long, the difference between someone who's a normal drinker indulging in these things and me is that normal drinker can indulge in these things and they don't end up getting drunk and burning their life to the ground. For me to engage in these things that may be the dubious luxury of normal men, for me, it means that I'm going to drink. And for me to drink is to die. And so I have to work a program. I have to make sure that when resentments come up, I can take it directly to step 10. When jealousy comes up, when envy comes up, I can take it directly to step 10 and I can clean that stuff up immediately. Because those are the greatest enemies, right? And that can be reconciled with everywhere in the book. It says that over and over again. So page 146, another Where's Waldo moment, another physical and mental, right? A class, as a class, alcoholics are an energetic people. They work hard, play hard. Your man should be on his mettle to make good. I'm sure I'm reading something wrong because I didn't pre-read. Being somewhat weakened and faced with physical and mental, right? There's that combination of words again. Down at the bottom of the paragraph, this is my highlight. And it's hard to read because for some reason I highlighted it in dark blue. He may wish to do a lot for other alcoholics, and something of the sort may come up during business hours. So it's like, well, if you have sponsees and they call you during business hours and you answer the phone, your boss is going to kind of raise an eyebrow about that. Like, is this really taking away from your business hours, from your family hours? A reasonable amount of latitude will be helpful. It's saying, yeah, his life as an ex-problem drinker depends upon constant thought of others and how they may best meet and how he may best meet their needs. This work is necessary to maintain his sobriety. Maintenance, right? In order to maintain sobriety, I got to be thinking of others. I got to give it away to keep it. And this is explaining to the employer, this is the one place where you need to be a little bit lenient, because his sobriety is dependent on him answering those phone calls, right? Him taking the time, even if it means showing up late for work. At least he's not showing up late for work drunk anymore. He's showing up late for work because he just went out on a 12-step call. And alcohol, okay, so after your man has gone along without drinking for a few months, you may be able to make use of his services with other employees who are, so you can put him to work, right? This is a really cool part in this chapter, who are giving you the alcoholic runaround, provided, of course, that they're willing to have a third party in the picture. An alcoholic who has recovered, yes, that word is in every single chapter of the book, an alcoholic who has recovered but holds a relatively unimportant job can talk to a man with a better position, which is awesome because alcoholics meet as equals, right? Being on a radically different basis of life, he will never take advantage. Of this situation. I must be reading that wrong. Being on a radical different basis of life, he will never take it. Oh, yes. So the alcoholic who you might, who is also in the workplace causing trouble or whatever, he might be able to talk to this alcoholic who seems to get better, even though he's in a different place in his life, because alcoholics, again, meet as equals. On the first line on page 147, it says, I guess I'll start at the bottom of the page. He will appreciate knowing that you are not bothering your head about him, that you are not suspicious. So this is, again, talking to the employer, nor are you trying to run his life. So he will be shielded from temptation to drink. If he is conscientious, following the program of recovery, he can go anywhere your business may call him. So this is again saying, don't shield him from drinking situations. Don't tell him that he, you know, needs to stay away from taking a client out to a bar or whatever, because again, we can reconcile that on page 100. Going down to page 100. It says, any scheme of combating alcoholism which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. And 120, another one is on 120. And that one says, we never try to arrange a man's life so as to shield him from temptation, right? Because that stuff don't work. You can even put your husband on the Greenland ice cap, and an Eskimo might show up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything. So after reading this book, I'm at the bottom of page 147. After reading this book, a junior executive can go to such a man and say approximately this: look, Ed, do you want to stop drinking or not? I love the forwardness in this. You put me on the spot every time you get drunk, and it's not fair to me or the firm. I've been learning something about alcoholism. I've been reading this big book. You should probably read it too. if you are an alcoholic, you're a mighty sick man. You act like one. The firm wants to help you to get over it. And if you are interested, there is a way out. If you take it, your past will be forgiven. And the fact that you went away for treatment will not be mentioned. That is amazing. I am so glad that that part is in the book, because it qualifies it, right? It qualifies it with saying, if you're interested, there is a way out. And do you want to stop or not? Because if you want to stop, we can help you. We won't hold it against you. If you don't want to stop, there's the door. So I guess I will read this last little portion on page 149. It says, today I own a little company. There are two alcoholic employees who produce as much as five normal salesmen, but why not? They have a new attitude and they've been saved from a living debt. I've enjoyed every moment spent in getting them straightened out. And so it's kind of cool that it ends the chapter by saying he does employ alcoholics. They're obviously, I think, recovered alcoholics, but he says that they are good workers and they make money. So a vision for you, I'm just going to start on a vision for you because it's the last chapter and it's a long chapter. I'm just going to start on this first little portion. Chapter 11, page 151. For most normal folk, so it's going to describe 90% of the world, drinking means conviviality, companionship, colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It's joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. Now it's going to talk about us alcoholics, but not so with us. In those days, in those last days of our heavy drinking, the old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an incessant yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that somehow, that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself, as we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily, we did. Then we would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror. The definition of terror is intense fear, panic, or dread. I woke up in intense fear, panic, and dread many a morning. Bewilderment. Extreme confusion of the mind. That is such a great definition for bewilderment. And I woke up with extreme confusion of the mind many a morning, looking out my window, hoping against hope that my car was in the driveway. And if it was, that it didn't have blood on it. If it wasn't, that I'd be able to find it. Bewilderment. Frustration. A deep, chronic sense of state of insecurity and dissatisfaction arising from unresolved problems or unfulfilled needs. Absolutely frustration. I couldn't just meet the mark and stay there. I always overshot the mark. And then, God damn it, I did it again. I'm never going to drink again. And then I'm drunk again. Frustration is an understatement. And despair. Definition for despair, the loss of all hope or confidence. When I finally met that last horseman, despair, I was finally ready for this program. The loss of all hope or confidence. I needed that gift of desperation in order to do this thing. And I'm grateful today for the despair that I felt coming into the rooms. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. So that's where I'm going to stop it for tonight. And we'll read one of the best chapters in the book, Vision for You, in its entirety next week. Back to you, Brooke. Thanks.
All audio and video files on the District6AA.org website or the District 6 in Area 15 YouTube channel are for personal use only. Reproduction, distribution, and commercial use are not permitted. In accordance with District 6 current practice, no faces are shown in our videos and audio is scrubbed for anonymity prior to publishing. Contributors whose voices are heard have given record and release consent. Opinions expressed by the presenter are their own and do not necessarily represent the group conscience of District 6 as a whole.